This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Poet Alan Shapiro grew up an athlete, not a scholar. His house had more TVs than hardback books, and he preferred to spend his time on the court or on the couch. But when a broken wrist dashed his basketball dreams in high school, he started writing poetry, mostly to express his despair at not being on the court. As a teenager, the only poetry he knew was the poetry of rock and roll, so his literary education began with Bob Dylan. Then he discovered the beat poets, so that by the time he arrived at Brandeis University, he was ready for his writing life to begin in earnest. Alan Shapiro has since published 10 books of poems, 2 memoirs, a collection of criticism, and now his first novel. And he's a distinguished professor of English and creative writing at UNC Chapel Hill. Alan Shapiro joins me in the studio today. Welcome back. Good to have you here.
Great to be here, Frank.
The story of poetry helping someone through despair is not uncommon. That happens, but not always with athletes and basketball players. Were you surprised at your sort of taking to poetry in that moment for you?
No. It seemed like a natural transition, not having anything better to do with my time. But basketball, actually, and being an athlete in general, was great preparation for a life of a writer in all kinds of ways. You got to, you know, basketball, you learn to do by imitating others. So there was a natural correspondence with poetry, where the only way you can learn to do it is by reading others. You know, I learned to play basketball by watching big kids on the playground. And when they were done, my friends and I would take the ball and between their games and try to do what we saw them doing until we made it our own, made it part of our own bodies. And that's how you learn to write poetry, the same way, by reading and imitating. The other thing about basketball as a preparation for a life as a writer, above and beyond the discipline it takes to do it, that is, you got to show up and play even when you don't feel like doing it, is that, you know, I got at a very young age, I got used to failing in public and not feeling overwhelmed by it or discouraged. You know, my coaches always chewed me out publicly. I have the dubious distinction of having fouled out of every single high school game I ever played in.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I was too aggressive. My dad thought that the referees were anti-Semitic, but that's another story.
Hard to prove that. But
yeah.
but and you said this really came home to you when you went to college. Yeah. You studied with J.V. Cunningham.
Yeah.
And so tell us that story.
Well, he it's amazing to think that he was my age. He's the age I am now. When I entered Brandeis in 1970, he was had white hair. He wore a Texas tie. He smoked Lucky Strikes in class. He did not suffer fools gladly, and he assumed you were a fool until proven otherwise. And the way he ran his classes were very different from the way creative writing classes are run today. You gave him your poems, and he would read them out to the class without saying whose poem it was, though you always knew it was the person tying their shoes under the desk weeping. So you knew who. But anyway, he would read it out, and then he would ask the class to critique it on the strength of hearing him read it. Now, he had emphysema, so he could hardly read above a whisper. So he sort of made everybody's poems sound like they were written by Peter Lorre. And as luck would have it, the first day of class, fall semester 1970, there were about 40 or 50 people in the class because he was the only creative writing teacher Brandeis had at that time. And I was in the class with graduate students to freshmen on all levels. And as luck would have it, he picked my poem first, and he held it up to the class. He read it. And at that time, as you mentioned in your introduction, I was heavily influenced by the beat poets, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, an old UNC alum whose words were all over the page. And Cunningham himself was a formalist. He wrote in rhyme and meter, old-fashioned in a really good way, but not anything like what I was reading or familiar with. And so he read my poem out. And he said, well, so what do you think, to the class? And, of course, nobody had anything to say. And then he just held it up to the class, showed them what it looked like on the page. And he said, this is nothing more than spilt ink. And he crumpled it up, threw it in the waste paper basket, and then went on to the next to the next poet. And it wasn't a pleasant experience, but it wasn't devastating either. So I showed up the next class meeting, and the class size went from 40 to about 5 or 6 because people headed to the doors. They didn't want to be treated like that. Whereas, again, for me, it was just like he had thrown down the gauntlet. I was going to prove to him that I could do this, because I was a competitive guy and I was used to competing on and off the page, on and off the court. And so I pretty much studied with him every semester. He was offering a writing class, or any kind of class for that matter, I took with him in order to demonstrate to him that I was worthy of his attention. And the most positive thing he ever said to me over the course of the 4 years that I was at Brandeis was the last time I met with him. I showed him a poem, he read it, and he said, "Well, Mr. Shapiro, if I like this sort of thing, I'd say you did it very well."
And you've been puzzling over the
ever since.
Ever since. Well, when you say that you were, you know, going to work with him and you're going to try to demonstrate something, were you trying to please him, learn his formalism, or were you trying to prove to him that he was missing something with these this kind of poetry?
Well, I am way too insecure to think that I had anything to prove to him. I thought that he had a lot to teach me, and even though he taught in his poems were epigrams. They're brief little poems in rhyme and meter. You know, good example of one of his epigrams is. Naked I came, naked I leave the scene, and naked was my pastime in between. So, you know, he was a Shakespearean scholar. He was a classicist. He knew a lot, and I knew nothing. And he taught, in a very epigrammatic way. He would, you know, I'd give him a poem, and he would give it back to me with, you know, he wouldn't mark it up. He would just say at the bottom of it, "No." Or he would say, "Too much of the pretty," or
So how do you, now take us through that, because you said you spent years working with him, you learned from him. How do you learn from that?
He would say, if you want to do this sort of thing, you should read George Herbert, or you should read Wallace Stevens, or you should read Ezra Pound. And so you had to learn actively with him. He didn't tell you what it was you were supposed to find in Herbert or Stevens or Pound. You just had to go read the work and then just put your work next to it and figure something out. So it wasn't to everybody's taste. But I came to love his own work, both his scholarship as well as his own poems. He's a very funny writer and also a very moving writer. But the work itself was very limited. And to his credit, he didn't want to encourage epigones. He didn't want imitators. Mm. He wanted people to find their own way. And that was, you know, so he wasn't a kind of smothering presence like a lot of teachers might have been.
Did you come to the program with a kind of confidence? And you know, because you can imagine it being replaced by a different sort of confidence at the end of 4 years.
Well, you know, confidence, I don't think, I guess on some, you know, deep, sort of animal level, there was a kind of confidence. But I've never been confident as a writer. I write because I can't not write, and that's the only reason I write. And in fact, one of the odd and maddening things about the life of a writer is that the better you get at writing, the better you get at imagining getting even better. So the discrepancy between the writer you are and the writer you want to be only widens as you improve. So to flourish as a writer, you have to cultivate a tolerance for inadequacy and failure because you're never going to make it, so to speak. You're never going to be the writer you want to be, because once that happens, you're finished. You know?
Well, and scarier still is, once you've established yourself as at least a successful poet, having published 10 volumes, you go off and write a novel.
Right. And for me, writing is just writing. And when any kind of writing is at its very best, it's poetry. So to me, it was like writing a novel was just like trying another form for the same, another avenue for the same impulse, which is to sort of give shape to your experience and make sense of your life.
So maybe a novel has to be poetic in its style and perhaps form, but not all not all poetry is novelistic in the sense that you don't need a narrative, right, to have a good poem.
No.
And
no.
You do need a narrative in a novel.
You do. It would help.
Yeah.
If you're trying to tell a story, a narrative is a useful thing. But I think that there are... I have always been a narrative poet. That is, there's always a kind of a context and something happens in the poems and you know that you're in a world that you share with others. It's not entirely a kind of inside a kind of lyric moment of heightened feeling, though there are such moments in the work. But I've always just seen all art as different forms of storytelling. Hmm. And so it was a natural transition. But if I felt like I was getting, and I never do, but if I felt like I was getting too good at something, I mean, the danger of that is that you become an imitator of yourself. Hmm. So you always have to figure out a way to make it new, start over, to be like a student, which is one of the reasons why I like teaching, is that the students remind me of where it is I always have to be when I sit down to write, which is at the limits of what I know how to do. And so writing a novel was a way to start over for me and start it with a new form, and every form makes it possible to write about some aspects of your experience and leaves others out. So I was able to find a language for parts of my life that I, for one reason or other, I couldn't find in writing in lines.
Well, we'll hear more about that, the new novel, Broadway Baby, as our conversation continues with poet-writer Alan Shapiro on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, talking with poet and writer Alan Shapiro. His debut novel is just out. It's called Broadway Baby. Tell us about this novel.
Well, the novel is about a Jewish American woman from the Boston area, born in the 1920s, who has three children, one of whom has talent for the stage, and like all Americans, like all people, she has dreams for herself and her family. And when one of her children, her son, looks like he may make something of himself as an actor, she channels a lot of her dreams and ambitions through him. The first part of it is about her childhood in an area of Boston called Dorchester, and. You know, her life is both, informed by much of what happened to all of us, all Americans through the 20th century.
What made you want to write this book?
That's a wonderful question. And as you mentioned in the intro, that it's a kind of fictionalized memoir. It's much more fictionalized now than memoir-like. It started as a memoir, as a series of personal essays about my family. And to go back to what we were talking about before, about forms and whatnot, I was basically telling stories that I already knew. And so there was no opportunity for discovery of anything. There was no surprise. I was just putting down on paper what was already in my head. And so it became really a kind of mechanical exercise, really. And so once I decided to start really just making things up, giving myself the freedom to do it, then it became new and different. And so that's sort of that's one reason why how I got into it. I've also, I know some of my best friends are fiction writers, and I've always envied them the experience of writing a long narrative because it's like a vivid, sustained dream they get to live in for months and years at a time. Whereas poems, you get in and out of relatively quickly, unless you're writing the Iliad or the Odyssey. But if you're just writing, primary lyric poems, even if they have a narrative element, it's still going to get in and out quickly. And so I love the idea of creating a world and being able to enter into it and stay in it for several years.
But as you said, you started out, this was going to be a memoir, and you got some advice along the way to turn it into a novel.
Yeah, I had showed one part of it to Robert Pinsky, who had our one-time poet laureate, who said, "Well, why don't you just reads like a novel? Why don't you just go all out and make it that way?" And I thought, you know,
I mean, did you take his advice right away, or did you struggle with that?
I just let it sit for a while. I said, "Oh yeah, sure." Yeah. And I can't actually even remember what was going on or not going on in my life at the time, but I just started to take some of these moments and develop into scenes and then just started to accumulate the scenes. And I did try, I did hedge my bets a little bit because the model for this book initially anyway was Evan Cannell's Mrs. Bridge. I don't know if you've read that book. It's a really fantastic novel and it's all constructed. I don't think there's a chapter in it that's longer than 2 pages, mm-hmm. 3 pages. So it's all just little tiny moments that accumulate over the course and become a kind of portrait of a life. And Mrs. Bridge, she's a middle class woman from Kansas in the middle decades of the 20th century, and so I tried to do the same thing. And I thought, if I did it that way and built it around small moments, then if I couldn't get it published, I could mine it for poems. So it wouldn't be a total waste.
Not a total loss. Yeah. Will you read for us?
Sure. I'll read it from the beginning of the book. The main character, Miriam, is 10 years old, is just about to be 10 years old, and her mother's going to take her to New York for the first time in her life, where she hopes to go to see the Ziegfeld Follies and see Fanny Bryce. And she's in the bathtub when the book begins, bathing herself, and she's looking out the window at a billboard of Fanny Bryce above a bakery store across the street. So she's just thinking about what's going to happen. Miriam looked out at Fanny Bryce looking in at her and thought, who knows, maybe in a few days she'd be watching Fanny Bryce herself. Maybe someday that would be Miriam up there on a billboard looking in on some other little girl who in a few days would be 10 years old and coming to New York City for the first time. Mattapan, Manhattan, they were practically the same word. Only two letters made the difference. Only two letters turned the everyday into the never before, the just here into the far away. How had she never noticed that before? Maybe this was what it meant to be 10, almost a teenager, almost an adult. What other new things would she soon be noticing? Next week, she'd be someone who had been to New York City, who'd been to Broadway. No one she knew, not one single person beside her mother, not any of her friends could say that. Not Zadie and Bubby, and certainly not her father. No, not him. Mattapan, Manhattan. She wrung the sponge out over her head and laughed as the water cascaded down over her face. It wasn't too long ago that Bubby used to bathe her. Bubby would lather her up until she wore an ermine stole of suds along her arms and shoulders and a white tiara on her head, and she would call her a regular little star, a little Fanny Bryce, a Sophie Tucker. Now, of course, she bathed herself the way grown-ups did. It was a funny thing to think about, to try to remember the last time Bubby bathed her. There had to have been a last time, though she couldn't recall it, a time like any other time that she and maybe Bubby, too, believed would just go on forever. And it did, or seemed to, until it didn't. And now she couldn't even find the memory of it. That must have meant there'd come a last time, too, to play with all her dolls and who knew what else. Now that she was older, how many things every day would she be doing for the last time without knowing it? Things she would not recall until too late, when whatever it was beyond recalling. Mattapan, Manhattan, Manhattan, Mattapan. She dunked her head under the water and opened her eyes. The blurry shapes of the drain with the white plug in it, her hands, her arms, all of her on the eve of her 10th birthday, a few days before her trip to New York City, were wavering with water shadows, shadows that the bathroom walls and ceiling would later seem to swallow as the water twisted down the drain.
Alan Shapiro reading from his debut novel, Broadway Baby. Certainly not a novice writer, having written, as we said, 10 volumes of poems, but poetry. This is the first novel. So the woman has 3 children. Tell us about those 3 kids. What happens to them?
Ethan shows talent for the stage. He's a good singer, a good dancer. Her oldest child is named Julie, who is somewhat aloof, and remote, and they never quite kind of understand each other or connect. And the youngest son is named Sam, who's kind of a loose stand-in for me, I guess. He's a very odd and kid with a lot of quirks and grows up to become a writer himself. and is somebody who manages or navigates the kind of tensions in the emotional tensions in the house by being funny and by trying to make people laugh so that they're not yelling.
Now, the siblings, some of the siblings in this novel are lost. And as you said, the book has become more novel than memoir. Right. But you lost two of your siblings.
I did. My sister, Beth, who was directed the library at Rice University, died of breast cancer in 1995. And my brother, David, who was an actor, Broadway performer for much of his career, died of brain cancer in 1999. So, so two of my siblings died. And in the book, the actor does die. The daughter just becomes estranged and sort of disappears from the family.
And that was that a decision that you had made? In other words, was it a change from the memoir and a decision that you had to make creatively?
Yeah.
And why?
There were just too many tragedies piled on one another, and it just was overwhelming. And you know, the book has a lot of sadness in it, but it doesn't have only sadness in it. There's a lot of humor. There's a lot of moments of intimacy and tenderness, and also misunderstanding. That just got to be too much of the same thing, you know.
Your poetry, though, is you are well known for your ability to handle grief in your poetry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and it is devoted to the losses in your life. In many cases.
I've written about all of. I've written a book about my brother, a kind of book length elegy for him called "Song and Dance." I have a memoir about my sister's death called "Vigil," and there are poems about her. Poetry is a way, and writing is a way of being happy. Even if what you're writing about is how unhappy or sorrowful you are. And so you take the cards you're dealt and you make the best of them. I think I'm not a big believer in the therapeutic value of literature, but if there is something therapeutic about writing about the bad things that happen to you, it's that in the act of writing, you are basically taking something that in life you had to passively suffer and transforming it into something that on the page you can actively make. And so it gives you, I think, it gives me anyway, I won't generalize, gives me some sense of agency and power over experiences that, in fact, I had no power over.
Well, and it seems to me that that happens for the reader as well, even though they're not in the act of you know, putting the word to the page.
Yeah.
There's a creative relationship with the work the way you invest yourself.
Yeah, you hope that it will, that, you know, I mean, one of the things, if you think about what it means to suffer emotional pain, like physical pain, it drives you back into yourself away from others. So the force of pain is inward and away from the external world. Writing is the reversal of that momentum. It takes what's driven you back into yourself and reconnects you with language. And in reconnecting with language, it reconnects you with community, other people, stories. And so I think that one of the beneficial effects of literature is that it makes people feel perhaps a little less alone, and that what happens to them, that they haven't been singled out by the fates to suffer some extraordinarily bad experience.
Because I'm always so surprised by people who hear about a subject, and they may say, yes, it dealt with the death of my sister and the loss of et cetera, and they say, oh, God, there's a happy subject for you. And I think you really wouldn't want – I'm actually – and I don't know why I'm surprised, because it does sound unhappy. But the experience of reading that and going through it, or seeing the well put together film, is precisely the thing that's going to help me cope.
Absolutely.
So why? Yeah. I'm surprised at people who don't want to read that book.
I know, and they say, it's too depressing.
You hear that.
Well, if it's done poorly, it will be too depressing. But if it's done well, and insightfully, and surprisingly, and transformatively, the formal patterning of a work of art converts, I think, the tragedy of subject matter into the comedy of form. You know,
and it
gives you a sense of power. That God, you look at the Greek tragedy, which I know quite a lot about because I've translated several of the Greek tragedies, and I know a lot about that world that produced them. And you know what? There's very little consolation in the tragedies, but the consolation is in the ability to face up to the worst that life can offer, and still make a human response to it.
So that's the comedy of form.
Comedy of form. That's a sense of giving form, giving shape to experiences that otherwise are just a squalor. I mean, they're just formless and messy and complicated. And it doesn't. Not that the form simplifies, but it clarifies, gives you a sense of clarity.
And it does have edges and page numbers and all of those. All of those things are kind of helpful.
And I do think that what Samuel Johnson said, that the mind can only requires the repose of truth. That is, truth is a form of repose, you know. And I do think that I'd much rather have a difficult truth told to me than a palatable lie.
Yeah. You know, when you talked about looking forward to the surprise that might come from writing fiction, and being worried that you were sort of mining the same material and too familiar with it. Do you get surprised when you write a poem?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Sure. Yeah. I mean, as I say, that writing a novel was like writing a poem, only on a larger scale. Yeah. But the same kinds of accidents, happy accidents, occur. Suddenly, you know, they can come in all kinds of odd ways. You know, we tend to think of writing as this kind of private, solitary act. But really, most of the things that we do artistically as well as otherwise are collaborative. And I, you know, in response to things that friends told me or my agent or my wonderful editor, Chuck Adams, opened up aspects of the book that I wouldn't have even thought to open up had they not made these suggestions. And so but that's also true with poetry. I mean, I have my few readers, people whom I show work to, and I show it to them in process, and they'll make suggestions that I wouldn't have been able to see on my own. Or at least not for a long while, and that's what I try to do as a teacher as well, is to try to open up possibilities rather than close them down. So the fingerprints of many people are all over everything that I do.
Will you read a poem for us?
Sure. Yeah. The book is called Night of the Republic, and one part of the book is set in public spaces at night with no people in them. So it's the imaginative project was if, let's say, a Martian anthropologist came down to the world and was looking around at night and trying to figure out what kind of creatures inhabit these sorts of spaces. And so there's everything from gas station restroom to a shopping mall to a dry cleaner to a church to an amphitheater. So here's I'll read you the first poem in the book. It's called The Gas Station Restroom. And I have in mind here the scuzziest, dirtiest bathroom off the interstate that you go to in utter desperation. but when you get there, you feel like you're in heaven. So it's called Gas Station Restroom. The present tense is the body's past tense here. Hence, the ghost sludge of hands on the now gray strip of towel hanging limp from the jam dispenser. Hence, the mirror squinting through grime at grime and the worn to a sliver of soiled soap on the soiled sink. The streaked bowl, the sticky toilet seat, air claustral with stink, all residues and traces of the ancestral spirit of body, free of spirit. Hence, behind the station, at the back end of the store, hidden away and dimly lit, this cramped and solitary carnival inversion, Paul becoming Saul, becoming sense, anonymous and animal. Hence, over the insides of the lockless stall, the cave-like scribblings and glyphs declaring unto all who come to it in time, heaven is here at hand and dark, and hell is odorless, hell is bright and clean.
Alan Shapiro reading his poem, Gas Station Restroom. What was the impetus behind the project itself, finding these uninhabited public places?
Well, I was, how I got to him was I went out late at night to get something for my wife, and I was in a a Harris Teeter at like 2 in the morning, and there was nobody there, and it was brightly lit. And I thought, man, what a strange place this is. You know, I wouldn't have noticed how strange it is during the day if there were people in it. But I'm here at night. I'm the only person here. There's one cashier who's you know, napping in front of the cash register. And I thought, this is a really weird place. And I thought, well, that, you know, and I thought, you know, I bet every place that we take for granted is weird if you can see it under the right aspect. And so I thought, well, I'm going to write about all these places at night. And it was suddenly I had available to me every single aspect of my life. Every store I ever entered became suddenly interesting if I imagined it without people in it at night. The only place that's written about during the day is a strip club, because that's the only time there'd be no people in it. So it's just an inversion of that.
Get rid of that. My guest this hour, Alan Shapiro, author of 10 books of poetry, 2 memoirs, a collection of criticism, and his latest novel is called Broadway Baby. He's going to be reading from Flyleaf Books tomorrow in Chapel Hill, but he is still on this program today, and we have more after this. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking this hour with Alan Shapiro, professor of literature and creative writing at UNC Chapel Hill, written 10 books of poetry. His latest novel, and his first novel, is Broadway Baby. He's going to read at Flyleaf Books tomorrow night here on the program today. We're talking about poetry. I wonder if I can get you to read another sure. poem for us, White Gloves.
Sure. Okay. This poem, White Gloves, is in the last section of the book. The first part of the book is set in public places at night with no people in them, though they're public places that are haunted by private dreams and obsessions. The last section of the book is set in a private place, the house I grew up in, but it's haunted by public events of one kind or another. So it's sort of an inversion of the first part of the book. And I got interested in objects that once were everywhere in our world and then vanished. And like, you know, men's hats, fedoras. Men used to wear hats all the time. Women used to wear hats. Very few women wear hats now. White gloves. Women always wore gloves. Wore gloves even just to go to the grocery store. And then one day they vanished. And so the poem offers a kind of theory, an unprovable theory, of why the white gloves vanished. Anyway, here's the poem, White Gloves. Nothing is soft as the silk-lined leather gloves kept in the top drawer of her dresser, the black ones and the cream ones, the slip-ons or the buttoned, laced up or ruched, the flared, the elbow length, the heavy, stifling odor of lilac and something talcum-like that rose from the open drawer, luster of the red dents, flat sheen of the petards, day in, day out for high and low occasions, until the last occasion, whatever it was, when none of them were ever worn again, not even the white ones, the most expensive, the ones she buried at the bottom of the drawer that I would now and then dig out and look at, as if by looking at the pattern of the stitching or the textures of the grain, I'd understand the meaning of the pictures of the president suddenly reaching for his throat and the first lady turning to look at him, turning to see what's wrong when the head explodes, and she's crawling out across the back of the car in a pink dress suit, pink hat, and bright white gloves.
Alan Shapiro reading his poem, White Gloves. Did you start with that image of what we said? You looked at the gloves, thought assassination, or did it come to you the other way?
I started just with the gloves. It actually came out of a conversation I had with a fiction writer, Charlie Baxter, about these sorts of objects that were familiar to us and then vanished. And I think it might have been that Charlie mentioned about gloves, and I started thinking about it, and so I started writing about it. And then I think, while, as so often happens, you know, the effects in works of art are partly, you know, the result of accidents. I was channel surfing and saw the Magruder film. Zapruder film of JFK assassination, and there was Jackie Kennedy crawling away from from her husband in a pink suit. And I did, what I could see more clearly than anything were these white gloves. And I so I just sort of put those two together.
Does it help you? Do you like to write poetry that way, to give yourself a kind of a challenge?
Yeah.
Public spaces. Yeah.
Over the years, I seem to be unable to write individual poems, but rather I write poems that are generated by some kind of idea. public spaces, or in the last section, there's 21 of these poems, 20 poems, and they're all just set of different objects in the house. I went in imagination to a particular object, and then just saw what was going to happen. You know,
has it ever happened to you the other way around, where some image just sort of jumps into your head, or perhaps a phrase or a sound?
Sure. And any number of ways. I mean, that's the thing about, you know, you just have to be open to the accidents of art and guard against turning the process of writing into some kind of method. You want every act of writing to be its own particular reckoning with language. You want every act of writing to be its own particular reckoning with life, and not to have some kind of, you know, sausage maker method that's just going to grind it out and make you feel productive, but everything you do will be.
Do you ever think about those accidents, where they come from, the sort of what's behind those?
Philip Larkin said it's sheer genius, but the traditional name for those accidents is the muse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's sort of the genius, it seems to me, is knowing what to do with it. It's first of all being open to it, not dismissing it as, you know,
readiness.
The readiness is all. Readiness is all.
Absolutely.
And I think, and that's, if you have too many boxes and too many frames in which everything fits, right, then the accident and the weird thing gets thrown away.
Exactly.
Doesn't fit.
And that's probably the most valuable thing. You know, it's the thing that doesn't fit. You need to construct a new box for it.
In the way, you know, just the way things go, the way we sort of have to make a living these days, more and more things have to fit. And I wonder where that leaves us who appreciate the creation and consumption of art.
Well, it's hard. Our culture allows for less and less room for the kind of improvised lifestyle that was conducive to a life of art. Rents are too high. Food costs too much. It's too much pressure, financial pressure on us. At the same time, and this is where I get great hope from my students, you know, when the economy tanked and the traditional avenues for success suddenly were dead ends, young people have had to figure out ways of improvising. And my students are so much more adventurous. My kids are so much more adventurous and creative than I ever was, even though I grew up in the 60s and, you know, during the anti-war movement and Woodstock, went to Woodstock and, you know, in fact, you know, have the dubious distinction of being the only person there among the 500,000 people in attendance who was unable to procure either sex or drugs. But that's another story. But I was only doing what everybody else did in those days. Whereas I see, you know, my daughter goes woofing, you know, goes onto these organic camps around the world and works for a couple of weeks, a month at a time. The kids are doing more creative things. I think even though our society is moving in a way that seems contrary to the creative spirit will find a way no matter what. And there will always be catastrophes to have to somehow, reinvent ourselves from. That's both a good thing and a bad thing, obviously. But I'm very hopeful. My students are so, so smart, so well-read, and so flexible in the way they think about their lives in ways that I certainly wasn't. And I hadn't seen in the 80s or 90s. The students were just completely pre-professional already, you know, and they're not like that anymore.
Well, that's incredible. And you've been here for quite a while. Does it feel like home, North Carolina?
Oh, absolutely. I've been I've owned property here since 1986. I've taught at UNC since 1995. My wife, Callie Warner, is from Asheville, so I feel married to the state. I feel complete, very much.
Has it been an adjustment here, teaching writing at UNC and not being a native Southerner?
No. The UNC students, though there's, I guess, a good proportion are from North Carolina. Many are not. Many are from out of state. But even the kids who are from North Carolina are incredibly talented. The writing community here has been extremely hospitable. As I said before earlier in the show, I think, my closest friends are among the fiction writers in our community, like Alan Greganis, Daniel Wallace, Pam Durban, Lee Smith, John Rosenthal, on and on. I mean, there is very little of the vanity and competitiveness that contaminate relations between writers in other cities that I've lived in, like in Chicago or.
You think there is less of that?
Oh, there's no question about it. Yeah, this is a much more nurturing, fostering place when it comes to the arts, and there's more interest in the literary arts from people who don't write here than there is in other places. There's a real appetite for it. It's not university-based as it is in other places. You know,
I've talked to other Southern writers who have left, who have gone other places to write, and I've talked with them about sort of recouping the landscape and trying to recover that as they move to other places. You wrote Broadway Baby here.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it's located in New York. Was that hard for you? Was that or easier to be away from?
I suppose it would have been just as easier had I been in Boston or New York. All any writer needs is time. I don't think where they are matters one bit. You know, as long as they have some time and some privacy, they can get their work done. But I have another book that I've finished, another novel that is almost entirely set in North Carolina and Texas, and so there is a lot of my life here in this second book that I've just finished.
And tell us about that book. It's a fascinating book. My Private Alamo.
It's called My Own Private
My
Alamo.
Own Private
My Own Private Alamo. It's about a guy writing a book about the Alamo, a Jewish historian who lives in the South, who discovers, and this is in fact true, that there was a deserter at the Alamo. And he was fought in the Napoleonic Wars, came to Texas in 1820 as a 50-year-old man, ended up befriending Jim Bowie. And when William Barrett Travis drew the line in the sand, that apocryphal moment when asked everybody who's willing to die for freedom to step over, he was the one dissenter. And I always wondered, how is it that we knew that he actually did that if everybody who saw it died?
Right.
Well, he jumped the wall, and from my perspective, what makes the subject irresistible is that he turns out to be Jewish. So this great Anglo-American story of sacrifice on behalf of freedom, has its source in a Jew. I mean, how perfect is that?
Well, and the smartest guy in the room was the Jew.
And the smartest guy in the room is the
Jew.
Because he left.
That was the smart thing
to
do.
What, me die? Are you kidding?
Then you came to the story in an interesting way, the way you found out about it.
Yeah, well, I was in San Antonio getting ready to give a reading from the Vigil, a memoir about my sister's death, and I had a couple hours to kill, so I went, always thinking that the readings were going to be a total disaster. I thought I would go to the Alamo because that would help put the disaster of the reading I was about to give into light, into perspective. And so I went, and I discovered this little. I was there in a tiny little case that had the gun in it, and it was donated by the descendants of the guy's name was Louis Moses Rose, the Yellow Rose of Texas. Not really, but that was and nobody at the museum really knew much about him. They said that they claimed that he wasn't really that he wasn't actually there, that he just said he was there. And there's a lot of controversy in Texas over this because it does tarnish the myth of white Anglo-American patriots dying on behalf of freedom. And so it was just a wonderful discovery. And so I actually there's a story behind this. I wrote a book proposal, and my agent actually sold it, got me a big advance. And then Callie and I had sat down to decide whether or not I was going to sign the contract. And I realized I could not do it. I could not accept money for something that I hadn't written yet. It would put way too much pressure on me.
Really?
Yeah. So I did not. I tore the contract up. Lost the agent, didn't write the book, and then about 10, this was back in, 2005, so then six, 7 years later, my wife had spent 2 months in Penland learning how to blacksmith. She's a welder, by the way, and a singer.
A welder and a singer.
Yeah. And so while she was gone, I had nothing better to do. I was there on my own. I started writing this book, and it wrote itself pretty quickly.
And it's about to be published, right?
No.
It's written?
It's written. It's been sent to Algonquin, and I'm waiting to hear.
Waiting to hear. What's the North Carolina connection? You said a lot of it takes place here.
Because it's the historian teaches at a school like UNC. Right. He falls in love with a woman very much like my wife, Callie, though. In this case, the historian has no children, has never married. And the woman is raising a daughter by herself, and so those two stories sort of intersect.
You know, as a writer, you think about the story of the Alamo itself. I mean, it is now this story that's embedded in the American character, and there's so much to suggest that it was never about freedom. This is a big land grab.
Oh, no.
We're stealing
Absolutely.
Land,
yeah.
And yet in the hearts and minds, it can never be any other way. No right. amount of documentation
right.
will change.
Right.
What is the power? What happens? How does a story take hold like that and defy any other kind of text in terms of its power and over your imagination?
Well, because it's simplified into a wish fulfillment, and people don't want to give up the wish fulfillment and resist anyone who tries to complicate the simple story with reality. They are regarded as cynics or
right.
Listen, I grew up watching remember the Alamo with John mm-hmm. Wayne. Those Fess Parker was a great Davy Crockett. I mean, imagine my surprise when I found out that Davy Crockett was just a windbag, and
a virulent racist.
William Barrett Travis deserted his wife and child in Alabama to go to the Texas Territories in order to escape his creditors, and then he met another woman, and he was engaged to be married. And in fact, at the Alamo ceremony, they have the ring. Apparently, he had given this engagement ring to the infant child of a woman there in the Alamo compound right before the final siege. And so when I went to the Alamo doing research for this book, and the docent was telling the story, and he was tearing up when he said, and he gave his engagement ring to Susanna Dickinson's young child and put it around her neck, and everybody's weeping. And I wanted to raise my hand and say, well, what do you think his wife and child back in Alabama would have thought about that wonderful sentimental gesture?
But you had a reading to go to.
Yeah, I had a reading
to
go to.
You were saved in the nick of time because you would have been the last casualty of the Alamo.
That's right.
Alan, thanks so much. Great to talk with you.
Well, thanks for having me, Frank. It's been a pleasure.
Alan Shapiro has two new books out, the novel called Broadway Baby. Another is a collection of poems called Night of the Republic. He reads at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill tomorrow night, Tuesday the 24th, then McIntyre's at Farrington Village on the 26th, and The Regulator in Durham on February 7th. That's our program. Thanks for listening to The State of Things. Find us at stateofthings.org. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.